And it turned out that, yes, I did have OSA, and it wasn't even very severe, but I started using CPAP and it absolutely changed my life. But I can recognise it in lots of other people. I've diagnosed friends and family with it and got them onto CPAP, but I didn't recognise it in myself. I can say wholeheartedly, it absolutely changed my life. And then suddenly I was able to function again. I was able to go out and see my friends again. I was able to do something other than just working and sleeping.
Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project, a platform for positive, evidence-based information to help you optimize your health. This is a special bonus episode. We're going to do a deep dive into one of my favorite topics, and that is sleep. This past year, more than most, has left a lot of us struggling with sleep. The first thing to say is you are definitely not alone. And secondly, no matter how bad it seems right now, with the right help, it can be sorted. If anyone's struggling with insomnia, please do listen to our interview with Dr. Jade Wu. You can find it on YouTube, the Fresh Heart website, or it's episode 16 of the Fresh Heart podcast. I've had so much wonderful feedback from people with insomnia to say how helpful Jade's advice is. In this episode, you'll find out how your sleep is structured, when you should seek help from a sleep doctor, and you'll find out more about the most common and incredibly underdiagnosed sleep disorder, obstructive sleep apnea. We're joined by two experts, Dr. Anita Jayadev, a respiratory medicine consultant specializing in sleep disorders, and JJ, a dear friend of mine who is an expert in sleep and ventilation. JJ very generously opens up about her own journey with sleep apnea. As a person who's researched and published on sleep, and additionally who now treats sleep disorders, even to her, she didn't suspect that she had obstructive sleep apnea for a number of years. Identifying it and treating it revolutionised her life. Much obstructive sleep apnea is underdiagnosed in the community, and that's why it's important to have a high level of suspicion. Her journey will inform you about the signs to look out for, particularly for women approaching the menopause. As humans, we spend one third of our lives sleeping, and it's deeply restorative for all our organs and bodily processes. The field of sleep medicine, however, is relatively new. Whilst incredible progress has been made, we're only just scratching the surface of our understanding. Over the last few decades, the ability to measure sleep has meant we can recognise and therefore treat sleep disorders. But the number of people with sleep disorders is increasing, and much of it remains undiagnosed. The most common sleep disorder is obstructive sleep apnea, where the walls of your throat relax and narrow during sleep. This then interrupts normal breathing, which in turn interrupts your sleep throughout the night, and it stops you getting enough deep restorative sleep. In one pivotal study, it's estimated that worldwide, obstructive sleep apnea affects almost 1 billion people. In some countries, it's thought to affect over 50% of the adult population. Sleep disorders cause excessive sleepiness, and if they're left untreated, also contribute to significant ill health. Not getting enough good quality sleep affects the whole body, including our heart, our brain, our memory, our mood, our hormones, and our weight. Don't worry, with the appropriate help, support, and treatment, sleep can be improved for anyone. That's why it's incredibly important to seek help if you think you, a friend, or loved one may have a sleep condition. We talk to Dr. Anita Jayadev about what she sees in her hospital practice.
So far, and for most of the sleep clinics that I've worked in, the most common sleep disorder that we see on a secondary care level is obstructive sleep apnea. So this is where people often may snore at night. So it's sort of like a spectrum. I explain it as being a spectrum where on one end you can kind of have just snoring, which is like a partial obstruction of your upper airway, right through to the other end where your airway is sort of obstructing throughout the night, which people are often unaware of. So it closes down, it can drop your oxygen saturations, and then you sort of keep waking up or having these arousals to try and get you to breathe. And that's essentially what obstructive sleep apnea is. And that's our most common referral to the sleep service. There can be lots of, when you take the sleep history from patients, lots of other sleep disorders that can present that you pick up along the way. I think more in a primary care and sort of GP level, we do still see a lot of overlap with insomnia. That's probably one of the most common things that people might notice, I guess, that they might go to their GP for first. And that's really where, despite having an adequate opportunity to sleep, people still have persistent sleep difficulties. And that's what we see with insomnia. And that's usually either chronic. So if it's happening more than 3 times a week, sort of over 3 months, we'd call that chronic. And if it's happening sort of less than 3 times a week, less than that, sort of more short term. And the short term insomnias tend to be more with secondary to kind of lifestyle stresses, typically. So I think that's one of the other most common things that we pick up in secondary care, but it's principally dealt with primary care. And the other thing is sometimes restless leg syndrome, which you can pick up on a sleep study as periodic limb movement disorder, we call it. But again, lots of GPs may also pick up restless leg syndrome, where patients often find it uncomfortable at night, particularly to keep their legs still. So it's sort of relieving to move them. So that can disturb sleep as well. I think they're the most common ones, I would say.
As Anita outlined, obstructive sleep apnea makes up the majority of referrals, but a large proportion of people are still in the community undiagnosed. So what risk factors should you look out for, and when should you seek help?
The risk factors for obstructive sleep apnea, the common ones that I think most people probably be aware of is weight. So it tends to increase with obesity and increasing weight. And the other thing is sort of neck circumference. So we often, you know, the distribution of weight can sometimes is quite relevant. So a larger neck tends to put a bit more of a load on the airway, especially when you're sleeping. So that the other main ones, sometimes people have quite a crowded sort of a bulky tongue, or, you know, what we call a crowded oropharynx. So again, can be weight related most commonly. But the other things to watch out for is sometimes if they've got sort of ENT, or sort of like a deviated septum, or do they feel like they've got a blocked nose and things like that, sinus problems. So things to watch out for on a history and examination. There are some apps, you know, and things people can sort of self-track, you know, to see if there's problems, lots on the internet as well. But I think the GP is the best place to start, because they'll take a proper history. You know, if you need any other blood tests, lots of things can contribute to poor sleep. It might be something completely different. So you kind of want a bit more of a focused history. So and they can often do some basic blood tests before, sort of thyroid function, that can make people very tired in the day. There are other reasons to be tired in the day, check iron levels, things like that. So I think the GP is the perfect place to start.
So the message is, if you're unsure, go to your GP. One of the biggest things I used to hear when I was doing sleep clinics for my PhD was patients reporting a change in mood, becoming more irritable or unable to concentrate. Sometimes the symptoms aren't obvious. When you go to a hospital clinic, they will ask further questions relating to your sleep.
The sorts of things that we'd want to know from patients when they come to clinic, like we've already touched on. So what's going on, like, so a sleep hygiene, we call it, as a sort of screening. So, you know, what time are they going to bed? What time are lights out? What typically are they doing before they go to bed? So are they on an iPhone, or are they on a sort of lots of blue screen light, we call it, because that can affect your sleep and your quality of sleep. So we need to know about that. When lights go off, we need to ask about when they typically get up and how often they get up during the night if they're getting up. So lots of patients with obstructive sleep apnea tend to get up a lot to pass urine overnight. So we call that nocturia, if you're doing that sort of more than you are in the day. We'd also want to know about other sort of diet, exercise, sort of the general lifestyle stresses. So are they feeling particularly anxious? Do they work shifts? What's their job like? You know, are they doing night shifts? Is that why their sleep pattern's a bit disrupted? We would ask about caffeine and alcohol. They can really affect sleep. So if you're having 5 cups of coffee at 7 in the night, you know, 7 p.m., that might not be good. But also, you know, people sometimes go to the gym very late, and that can also play a part on how then you go to sleep and affect your sort of sleep hygiene. So quite a general screening thing about them predominantly picking up things that might contribute to insomnia, I suppose. And then with obstructive sleep apnea, what we really want to look at is what's the best history often is there a bed partner that can often comment on things that the patient may not be aware of themselves or anybody else in the house? So, for example, snoring can be quite useful, or sometimes partners will say, God, he really sounds like he stops breathing in the night, or sounds like he's choking or making funny noises in the night. So that can be a really valuable history.
What is the Epworth sleepiness score?
So the Epworth sleepiness score is like a screening questionnaire that we would often ask people like just before they come into the clinic or whilst they're in the clinic, and is sort of nationally recognised. It's very general questions. So we'll ask you to grade how likely you think you are to fall asleep in certain situations, sort of from 0 to 3. So 0 being not at all likely to fall asleep, or no chance of dozing, with 3 being highly likely. And then there's a set of questions which we'll ask you to grade. So, for example, if you're sitting down to read in the after, you know, sitting down after lunch, how likely are you to fall asleep if you haven't had any alcohol? Or, you know, if you're in a meeting or a public place, how likely are you to fall asleep? So there's different questions that we ask, and then it give you a score at the end of it. And that can be quite useful to see how sleepy people are. It's not very specific. I often do say to when I'm teaching on sleep courses and giving, you know, telling our junior doctors that on its own, if you asked any junior doctor, especially during the pandemic, these questions, they may score very highly on the Epworth score, or any newborn, you know, young parents with a newborn, they may equally score highly. But I find what the studies have shown is quite useful is if you combine your Epworth score sometimes with some other factors, sort of your weight, being male, you know, it can give you a bit more of a specific guide as to how likely they are to have obstructive sleep apnea. The other thing that's useful about the Epworth score, sometimes if you have given somebody treatment for obstructive sleep apnea and you've given them, say, CPAP therapy, which is a type of treatment, to use that score before and after to see if it's come down, you know, it can be useful to see if your treatment's been effective. So I think a change of a 2 at least is significant. So that's useful.
We'll link to an example of the Epworth sleepiness score in the show notes. If you've been referred to a sleep consultant such as Anita, they will then refer you for studies to directly measure your breathing during sleep. My good friend JJ talks us through the different sleep studies available and what they measure.
Well, there's a lot of different sleep studies that you can do, but the simplest one that we do is called a pulse oximetry, where we just measure oxygen in your blood and your pulse rate. That's the simplest. And we use that to sort of diagnose obstructive sleep apnea, just to get the most severe people screened and started on therapy. And so I've got one already attached to me here, just so you can see. So it's one of these little pulse oximeters attached to your finger, and then it's attached to a little wristwatch. So that records your oxygen unit and your heart rate. And we can look at your oxygen dips as that relates to your having pauses in your breathing. The next level of sleep study is a respiratory polygraphy, and that looks at both the oxygen and the pulse rate, and it also looks at the effort to breathe, and it looks at the airflow here at your nose and your mouth. And we use that to diagnose sleep apnea, be it obstructive sleep apnea or central sleep apnea, which is when your brain doesn't tell you to take a breath. The next level of sleep study is a polysomnography. So that means that we measure all of the things that we do in a respiratory sleep study, so effort, pulse oximetry, airflow at your nose and mouth, but we also measure your brain waves and we stage your sleep. So we determine what stage of sleep you're in. Now, this would involve having little electrodes attached to your head. So you have one here and here to measure the eye movement. You have ones on your chin to measure your muscle activity. And then you have some other on your scalp. And so they measure your brain activity. So often when people get set up with all this equipment, they think, how am I going to fall asleep with all of this? But actually, most people fall asleep and we get some information. So often you'll get really simple, a much simpler sleep study than the full sleep study, which doesn't take that long to set up. And you can do most of them you can have done at home without anyone with you. You set the equipment up yourself after being shown by a sleep technician. Since COVID-19 has got us all staying home and not able to go into hospital for elective things like this, most places have been sending out their sleep study equipment to their patients, and then their patients put the equipment on at home, sometimes with a video chat or sometimes just with the instructions on paper. They do the sleep studies on themselves, and then they send the sleep study equipment back to the hospital for download. So it's they're fairly simple. The ones that we do just for to diagnose obstructive sleep apnea, they're pretty simple sleep studies and they're not too hard to set up on your own.
This is important information. Even during lockdown in a pandemic, if you think you've got a sleep disorder, you can still get a limited or the next level up, a respiratory sleep study. For people with obstructive sleep apnea, this is sufficient. It can diagnose the condition and you can start treatment. For a small number of patients, it's less clear and they need the full sleep study. This is a sleep study that enables us to stage your sleep. Throughout the night, we cycle through a number of sleep stages, each with their own characteristics on the sleep study.
The only way you can measure the sleep stages is by having all the equipment attached to, so the highest level of sleep study. And we look at the combination of what your eyes are doing, what your muscle activity is doing, and what your brain activity is doing. And we use that to determine what stage of sleep you're in. So we have what we call REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement sleep, and non-REM sleep, which has several different stages in it. When we look at non-REM sleep, that includes the light stages of sleep, N1 and N2, which are sort of transition stages, N3, which is deep sleep. Deep sleep is a stage of sleep that gives you a feeling of being refreshed. So deep sleep happens at the start, more at the start of the night, and then rapid eye movement sleep happens more toward the end of the night, in the second half of the night. When you're in deep sleep, you are oblivious to what's going on around you. So all of your senses are a little dulled. And this is the stage of sleep you're in when someone shakes you and you don't wake up. Rapid eye movement sleep is when your body is at its most paralyzed, so that has the least muscle activity. It's not really paralyzed because your eyes are moving, your heart's still beating, there are some muscles that are still active, but there is overall, we consider it to be a paralyzed body with an active mind. So this is when you're doing most of your dreaming, is when you're in rapid eye movement sleep. The other thing about REM sleep, as we call it, is that your senses aren't dulled. So you might hear your alarm clock and then you build that into your dream because you actually are aware of your surroundings. The way that we understand sleep is what happens when you don't get enough sleep. So if we look at rapid eye movement sleep, if you deny someone rapid eye movement sleep by waking them up constantly every time they go into rapid eye movement sleep, what we find is that their memory is affected. So in the long term, they are unable to lay down their short-term memory into long-term memory. If you deny someone deep sleep, then they are not refreshed when they wake up and they find it very difficult to function. So if we look at deep sleep, if you have 4 hours of sleep, you get a lot of deep sleep at the start of the night. So you can wake up after 4 hours of sleep and function fairly well. But if you only get like 1 hour of sleep, it's much harder to function at a decent level.
If you have a sleep study, we look at how many times the oxygen level is dipping. If your oxygen level drops consistently throughout the night, you may need treatment with CPAP or continuous positive airway pressure. Treatment for obstructive sleep apnea, when properly delivered, adjusted, and supported, can revolutionize life. It allows you to get through all the important sleep stages, get the nourishing deep sleep, as well as the emotional processing of REM sleep. JJ talks to us about what CPAP is and how it works.
The treatment, the gold standard treatment for obstructive sleep apnea is continuous positive airway pressure. It's delivered from a machine that is attached to you via a hose and a mask that goes over your nose or your nose and your mouth, depending on what you require. It delivers pressure, which holds your upper airway open, and that way you can breathe in and out without it narrowing or collapsing. It looks a little daunting when you first see the therapy, and perhaps it was easier for me because I already knew what it looked like and understood how to use it. But you just have to try and keep the mask on all night, whenever you're asleep. If you have a nap, use it while you have a nap as well. And it keeps your airway open and allows you to have normal sleep or fairly normal sleep.
Which CPAP mask is best for me?
There's lots of different masks. There's not a correct mask for everyone. There's just a correct mask for you, one that fits you the best. Mask design has improved over time, so they're a lot better now than they used to be. Most people will be able to find a mask that works for them. I think you have to stick with it and try them for a little bit. And if you're getting lots of leak, and if you don't feel like you can keep it on for the whole night, then asking to try another mask is completely reasonable. If you ask people the mask they think they're going to like the best, it's the smallest, simplest, with the least headgear, is what we call the soft part that goes around your head. It'll be the smallest and simplest part. But actually, often people don't find that one the most comfortable because it sort of gives you a bit of a jet of air up your nose. So there's real variation in what people can tolerate. And even understanding and knowing all the masks, when I tried them myself, I still ended up with the one I thought I wouldn't like, but actually that was the one that felt the easiest to use overnight. So it is trial and error. And I think the other point is, if you're claustrophobic, the masks you think will be best for you often are not the best for you. So you have to be open-minded and try things and find out what's going to work the best for you. Sometimes the patients that I would see, they'd come back after 3 months of using the machine and I didn't recognise them because they just looked completely different. They were bright, they were perky, the bags under their eyes had disappeared. That just seemed like a different person if it had worked really well for them.
Now, JJ has had her own journey with sleep. She developed obstructive sleep apnea and didn't realise. She opens up to us about how treatment changed her life, giving her a first-hand appreciation of what people with sleep apnea go through.
When I was in my late 20s, I had a job where I had started work. I was working in IT back then, and I started drinking coffee with the people that were there. And I just didn't realise what an impact the coffee was having on my sleep. So I was unable to get to sleep at night, and I had no idea what was causing it. And I just started drinking alcohol to try and help me get to sleep. And that it is an effective way of getting yourself to sleep, but you don't have as good quality sleep if you use alcohol as a way of overcoming insomnia. So it's not a good, sensible idea, but I was young and it was the only thing I could think of. And then I'd wake up at 3 a.m. and not be able to get back to sleep. And really that was the point at which the coffee was still affecting my alertness and the alcohol no longer was, and I couldn't get back to sleep. And it took ages before I suddenly had a light bulb moment of, oh, maybe I shouldn't be drinking coffee at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And as soon as I stopped drinking the coffee, my insomnia was solved and I felt like such a twit. But it's really difficult to have insight into your own issues, be they psychological or physical. Sometimes you just don't see the thing that's staring you in the face or that's obvious to someone else.
Recognising obstructive sleep apnea.
The other issue that I had has been more recent, and that's as I've gotten older. So women don't have the same propensity to have obstructive sleep apnea as men. We're not as we don't have the same risk factors for it, and that part of that is to do with the female sex hormones, progesterone and estrogen, which impact your respiratory drive, and they also impact the tone of your muscles and the muscles of your upper airway. As I aged, I didn't realise that this was impacting me, and that as I went through menopause, that was having an impact on my sleep. All I knew was I was absolutely exhausted and I could barely function. I had a couple of years where all I did was work and sleep, and that was it. And it was only actually till I started waking up in the night in a sweat, a cold sweat, that I thought, it's just, and my heart racing, that I thought, you know, this is just so obviously obstructive sleep apnea. I'm going to do a study on myself. And it turned out that, yes, I did have OSA, and it wasn't even very severe, but I started using CPAP and it absolutely changed my life, which seems ridiculous given that I've worked in this area for 15 years or so, almost 20 years now, that I didn't even recognise it in myself. But I can recognise it in lots of other people. I've diagnosed friends and family with it and got them onto CPAP, but I didn't recognise it in myself. I can say wholeheartedly, it absolutely changed my life. And then suddenly I was able to function again. I was able to go out and see my friends again. I was able to do something other than just working and sleeping.
Sleep disorders and the menopause.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that sleep disorders in perimenopausal or postmenopausal women aren't well recognised by GPs, and even by menopause consultants who specialise in it, they don't necessarily realise that this is a big deal as far as the menopause is concerned. So what I would say is, go to your GP, ask them to refer you to a sleep clinic, and when you're at the sleep clinic, make sure that you say where you are in this process of menopause, because it's quite an important part of it, and that you know that postmenopausal women are more likely to have sleep disordered breathing. So once you have said that, then they should refer you on to the things that you need to describe are your excessive daytime sleepiness. If you've ever woken up with your heart racing, or you're waking up in a cold sweat, or you're falling asleep during the day, or there's a whole lot of symptoms that are only specific to women and that men don't describe. So women often describe fatigue rather than sleepiness. They describe muscle and joint pain. Insomnia is one of the things that they describe, and when actually it's obstructive sleep apnea stopping them getting to sleep. And depression. These are the things that often they present with, and they don't often have their bed partner describe seeing them have pauses in their breathing. For men, usually the bed partner will recognise that they're snoring heavily or they're having pauses in their breathing, and their bed partner will make them go and have a sleep study. But for women, that's a bit less likely to happen. So it doesn't, you don't even need to snore loudly as a woman for you to be having significant obstructive sleep apnea. And the other thing is that it, you don't even have to have the full pause. You can just have a reduction in the reduction in airflow, which means your airway narrows somewhat as you fall asleep. And just that is enough to wake women. So the reason that women don't get diagnosed as easily with it or aren't recognised as easily is that they have a much brisker response to stimulus when they're asleep. So they are much more likely to arouse from sleep from a very small change in the environment. That's sort of why in every TV show where they wake up because someone's broken into the house, it's always the wife that elbows the husband, wake up, there's someone in the house, because they've woken up to the noise, whereas men don't wake up to outside stimulus quite as easily. And because of this, just a change in the patency of the airway, just a reduction in the diameter of your airway from falling asleep can wake a woman up. So we're not as likely to have as long apneas. We're not as likely to have as severe events, but they are more likely to arouse us from sleep. So it fragments our sleep and ends up with us being just as sleepy for less severe disease.
Thank you to JJ for being so generous with her journey. Thank you also to Anita, who has been working on the front line of the pandemic since it began and took time out of her incredibly busy schedule to talk to us. The important message here is if you think you've got an issue with your sleep, go to your GP, who can then refer you on to a sleep consultant for further sleep tests if required. Thank you so much for listening. If someone you know could use the information, then please do share this episode. You can check out all the episodes on our website, www.freshheartproject.com. We would be so grateful if you could comment, subscribe, and give this a 5-star rating. This helps us get the Fresh Heart message to more people. This podcast is not a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps create great change. This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.